This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
You're now listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. After decades of maintaining a national poverty line that was criticized as misrepresenting the true scale of poverty in the country, Malaysia recently made the decision to revise the line to 2,208 ringgit, taking our official poverty level up 14 times to 5.6% of the population. Philip Elston, a vocal critic of the previous line, commended this as a step forward. But the question is it enough? To find out today, I speak with Philip Elston himself, former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. Philip, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Thanks, Roshan.
So, Philip, I think I just want to start off with, there are many theories and thoughts about the state of poverty in Malaysia. What would you say is the biggest misconception we have?
Well, I guess the biggest misconception, of course, is that there hasn't been any poverty in Malaysia. And it's strange for an outsider to come into a situation where people genuinely believe that somehow Malaysia has escaped this particular scourge when all countries around you, including the one I come from, Australia, have very significant poverty rates. It just sort of was allowed to happen that way, I think, in Malaysia. The line was set in 1970. There was no imperative to be reviewing it and so on. When suggestions were made, they were resisted. And then at a certain point, it gets very difficult, which, of course, is the significance of the new development, because no government wants to say, you know what happened under our watch? Poverty increased 14-fold. Because that sounds disastrous. And so administration after administration just put it off, put it in the too hard basket, and kept pretending that really Malaysia was alone in the world in having no poverty.
In your view, is this a significant step forward beyond the fact that the government has recognized this as an issue?
Yeah, I think it's a very significant step forward. I mean, it clearly is one of those glass half full, glass half empty situations, which are common. On the one hand, I was genuinely concerned that the new government, new-ish government, would want to revert back to the line from the Najib's era and say, no, we're not changing it. It remains 0.4. And that would have been very worrying. So I think it is a very big step to have changed the methodology to the point where it is now 5.6% of the population. But the truth, unfortunately, is that that is still a huge underestimate of the extent of poverty. But part of me is a realist, and I understand that change of this magnitude has to be taken one step at a time.
Yeah, in the past, I think Professor Dr. Martin Revelyon of Georgetown University said that the line was around 15%, and I think the World Bank noted in the past around 19%. What's your best estimate of the Malaysian poverty level?
Well, I couldn't pretend to know better than either Martin Revelyon or the World Bank. I've been in touch with both of them at length. I think Revelyon would currently put it at about 17% in Malaysia in terms of relative poverty, and the bank, as you say, something like 19%. There's no reason for me to contest those scientific assessments. They're both very objective and highly respected, so I would take that as the starting point.
I guess one of the concerns that has come up with the new line is the lack of transparency around the methodology behind it. In a recent report by the World Bank, they noted that when the poverty line methodology was updated in 2005, the EPU and the UNDP published a book to explain the methodology, whereas in the recent announcement, it was accompanied by a three-page summary in the Department of Statistics report. Do you have similar concerns around methodology here?
Yes, I think anyone who's looked at this... It's essentially a political compromise. You know, you can imagine the conversation in the minister's office, in the ministry. Minister, I think it's probably around 17%. Don't be ridiculous. We're not going to go from 0.4 to 17. That's completely out of the question. But we do want to make an important step here, so let's make it manageable. And someone says, well, I'll come up with a methodology, but it won't be particularly compelling. We won't be going into great detail, but we'll make sure that it comes out at a level that satisfies both the need for realism in economic terms, but also political palatability. And so what you've got is this very poorly explained methodology, which hopefully won't last too long. I think most observers would like to think that the 12th Malaysia plan would be a very good opportunity to put forward a more compelling basis and a stronger set of analysis.
Yeah, I guess overall, everyone's hoping that this is just a stepping stone towards a much larger move and change, and at least something with better methodology or more transparent methodology behind it. And when you look at the new line that's come up, what are your concerns when it comes to the new methodology?
There's a broader issue, of course, of transparency in the Malaysian system. Speaking as an outsider, but someone who first visited Malaysia in 1971 and has been back many times in between, so I have some sort of deeper sense of Malaysia. It's a superb country. It has a very sophisticated elite, both educational and bureaucratic, but it doesn't have a tradition of transparency. Now, you know, whether that comes from the colonial days, whether it's from the emergency, whether it's from the ethnic tensions over the years, it's not clear. It's probably a combination of all of those. But the bureaucracy is not accustomed to explaining itself particularly. And it doesn't feel that it needs to lay out a methodology. It doesn't feel that it needs to be particularly consultative. In some other countries, at least, I think there would have been a serious public consultation on a process such as this to say, okay, the government has taken the decision in principle. What we've got is not accurate and not sustainable. How should we do it? But that's clearly not what happened here. It's all very much behind closed doors. I think the concerns are that until you are more transparent, you can't be held to account very effectively because you don't know what you're trying to evaluate. You're not going to be able to reach very well-defined policy prescriptions unless you spell out what the issues are. I think the World Bank, and I agree with this, has expressed a lot of concern that what are called basic non-food needs, clothing, housing, transportation, and so on, are not really taken into account in this new line. They are such a low percentage of the overall measure, and I think that really needs to be adjusted quite significantly in the months, years ahead.
Philip, you bring up basically the non-monetary aspects of poverty calculation, and we're going to get into that in just a little bit. I've been speaking with Philip Elston, former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan. This morning, I'm speaking with Philip Elston, former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. Now, Philip, when we take a look at the measurement of poverty overall, generally income levels are used as the baseline, or in some cases, the entire measurement. But there are non-monetary aspects as well. What do you think is a better way to measure poverty, or at least take that standard forward?
Well, it's really important to come up with a methodology that reflects the actual costs in Malaysia of health, education, housing. And that isn't currently the situation. The current benchmark really uses an indicator that is going to be for a country that is much lower income than Malaysia. Obviously, people living in KL are very aware of the high nature of these costs, but it's true in most of the urban areas in Malaysia, and thus the measure is not going to really evaluate effectively and address the problems of poverty in those areas.
What else needs to be included in the overall measurement and analysis? You know, when I spoke to Professor Martin Ravalian earlier in the year, he emphasized the fact that health and education were really some of the most important things when it comes to income inequality and poverty, because these are two things that can really make or break someone's life cycle, essentially. What are your thoughts on the other elements that need to be included in the analysis?
I think, certainly my own research in Malaysia showed that there are significant problems in both areas. In education, I know that Sabah and Sarawak, of course, are not a huge part of the population, but the educational situation in those two areas is really terrible. The number of dilapidated schools that are not being repaired, and thus the low levels of education that students are able to get is a real problem. I think in the health area, Malaysia has a system which in principle is very good. It has extensive coverage, that's admirable, but it's also clear that the services available in the public system are deteriorating quite considerably, while the private sector health is zooming ahead. And that's great for members of the elite, but it's not great for the rest. And more importantly, it's not great for the economy, because you need both these underpinnings of decent education and good health. And it's particularly true of a country like Malaysia that aspires to create more skilled jobs, and really come up a notch with the crisis in oil prices and so on. It's going to be very important for Malaysia to be able to diversify. And you can't do that economically unless you have a healthy and well-educated population.
It essentially comes back to the quality of the human capital in the country itself and how you bring that up. Now, when we look at data, now data is obviously a bedrock to any sort of measurement. And with that in mind, when you were Special Rapporteur, the UN report noted that there was a lack of information for a country of Malaysia's state of development. What kind of data is lacking to get a better, more representative picture of poverty in Malaysia?
Well, first of all, there's some there's quite a lot of data that's not collected. Secondly, it's often not disaggregated. So a lot of the statistics, I would say, well, you know, tell me about the situation of indigenous groups, or tell me about the different non-Bumiputra groups in this area. And the answer is, oh, we don't disaggregate. You know, I'm sorry, it's a 90% rate, whatever it is. And I'd say, well, that's great. It might be, you know, 95% for the Bumiputras, but my expectation is that for the indigenous, it's, you know, 15%. And the answer would be, oh, well, we don't know that because we don't have those statistics. And that makes a huge difference. It's not just, it's not pandering to minorities. It is that in any country, you know, look at the Aborigines in Australia or wherever, there are groups that need very special measures and you need to have a good sense of where they're at. You've got to have the statistics. And I think the third problem in Malaysia just is the inaccessibility of the statistics that are there.
Looking forward, Philip, what kind of policies do you think Malaysia needs to address poverty here?
I think tax is always at the heart of poverty policy. Malaysia is actually spending relatively little on social protection compared to its neighbours. But that's also because it's taking in significantly less in taxes. And there's a common misbelief that if you have a low tax system, that's the key to economic prosperity. But we know from so many studies in so many countries that a really low tax system is the key to gross inequality and great riches on the part of a small elite. It doesn't account for the thriving prosperity. Even the IMF has been saying now for years that significant inequality is bad for economic growth and development. And I think Malaysia needs to grasp that nettle and say, look, we've got to re-examine the tax system, make sure that we are bringing in enough, that it's equitable, and that will give us considerably more money to spend on basic social protection than we presently do. And you don't get good social results if you don't spend money on it.
Philip, when you say equitable, what does that mean?
Well, obviously it's up for every society to measure, but when I think of taxation, I think of a basic commitment to forms of redistribution, for example. That's what taxes have to be all about. That's the whole notion that there are always going to be a lot of people in any given country who cannot afford basic necessities. And it's not because they're stupid or lazy or ignorant or whatever. It's because they don't have the opportunities. They haven't had the education. They haven't had the health care. They haven't had the training. And they're simply not able, without forms of assistance, to really thrive and prosper. And so an equitable taxation system is progressive, and it makes sure that when the government spends money, that goes overwhelming in the social area, and when it gives tax deductions and tax breaks and so on, that goes significantly towards redistributing wealth. And that's not the case in Malaysia, where the wealth remains very much in the hands of a small elite, and that elite is getting wealthier at the expense of the rest of the nation. And it's just not a good economic policy.
You know, when we talk about taxes during this time right now, as it is, we're expecting even less tax revenue as businesses are facing pressures, as individuals are losing their jobs. That just equates to less taxes in the government coffers. And this brings to mind, I guess, the impact that COVID-19 could potentially have on poverty overall. Are you able to maybe quantify the potential damage for us, or what are your key concerns here?
I mean, if you look at the statistics or the estimates that come out of the World Bank and the IMF and so on, they show a pretty dramatic loss of growth, negative rates for the next year or perhaps 2 years. I guess my concern, to the extent that I'm following the media in Malaysia, is that your good fortune with COVID-19 so far might be leading some people to play down the potential economic consequences. And sadly, I think that's probably mistaken, in the sense that Malaysia is very much part of a global economy and a regional economy, and it is going to be affected pretty significantly. So government revenues need to be rethought, taxes need to be rethought, because there will be a lot more people who will fall into poverty. And these will not be the traditional groups. That's what becomes interesting, because governments that are based on the middle class's support, I think, will become increasingly attentive to the plight that many people in the former middle classes are going through as a result of COVID.
And, you know, we've highlighted quite a few of the shortcomings in the Malaysian poverty policy and just general bureaucracy around it during this conversation. What are the bright spots in Malaysian policy here, if any?
Well, you know, these things, everything's relative. And the starting point, of course, I'm someone who focuses on poverty, so all I want to see is the bad news. But the reality, of course, is that Malaysia has had, you know, extraordinary rates of growth. The Malaysia that I saw and liked so much in 1971, what's that, almost 50 years ago, is no more. You know, it has been transformed beyond recognition. There's no question of that. So there's an awful lot of very good news. But the challenge there is that when you have done as well as Malaysia has done, when you've prospered so much, then you actually have the opportunity to bring everyone with you and not to leave large numbers of people behind. And of course, there's the other elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned, which are the foreign workers who make up, maybe as many as 6 million people. And generally, that's an issue that the government hasn't wanted to approach in any systematic or, I would say, reasonable way. Everyone prefers just to look in the other direction and to benefit immensely from the cheap labour that's available, but not to take even fairly basic steps to ensure that those workers are decently treated in a variety of ways.
In your experience and observations, what are the greatest stumbling blocks to eradicating poverty overall?
I'm afraid my basic line is that poverty is a political choice. I think that it's attitudes, basically, that stop us eliminating poverty. So as long as we have a completely meritocratic view of life, and I would suggest that Singapore is the ultimate example of that, but I'm sure it's influential in Malaysia as well. A meritocratic viewpoint basically says, I've got where I am because I'm really smart and I've really worked hard and I deserve it. And a loser like you is down and out because you haven't worked hard, you haven't done anything to change the situation, and you deserve what you're getting. And that's all there is to it. And the problem is to try to get policymakers out and say, come and speak to the people who are poor. Come and talk to them about their life cycle, their life history, and what their opportunities are now, what they want. And the answer is they don't want a big, you know, handout from government. But they want their kids to get some medical treatment when they're sick. They want their kids to be able to go to a school that's going to teach them certainly reading and writing and arithmetic, but also in the longer term, digital skills and enable them to get jobs. And I think that the meritocratic outlook blinds us to much of this because we think the poor are getting their just desserts and it's not for us to help them. And that's just not true when you get out and meet and mix with people who are living in poverty.
Philip, with all this in mind, what lessons can Malaysia learn from other countries that have dealt with poverty more effectively?
I think that the first point is acknowledgement. Just facing up to the realities is really important. Secondly, that this is not just a humane gesture, but is an economic investment. That it's the next step for a society like Malaysia to eliminate these pockets of real poverty where people are living under terrible conditions and to bring them into Malaysia's modern economy as part of a really thriving workforce. That's the next challenge, to see poverty elimination in positive terms. In Western democratic countries, people are always reluctant to give much credit to China. But if there's one thing that Xi Jinping deserves credit for, it's saying, I'm going to eliminate poverty. I'm going to make that a political priority. And the Chinese government has, and they've achieved extraordinary results. Be great to see other governments making it a priority as well, albeit for very different reasons.
All right, Philip. On that note, thank you so much for your thoughts this morning.
Thanks, Roshan.
I've been speaking to Philip Elston, former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, and this has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.